irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Carulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Just had to push the unmute button. Sorry. This is your host with the most, Nikki Carulla. We're going to jump right into the interview. We got a special guest, musician, keyboardist, and arranger and writer, correct?
Correct.
Lau Tizer. Give it up for Lau Tizer.
Wow, thank you so much.
See, the studio audience, we hide them. We hide them in the corners. So I want to first talk to you about your name, because okay. It's such a unique name. Tell me about your name and the heritage.
Yeah, okay, so Lao is Chinese. Okay. I'm named after the Taoist philosopher Lao Tzu, if you're familiar with Taoism, wrote the Tao Te Ching, an ancient Chinese philosopher. But my last name is Tizer, which is Russian Jewish, so I have a very unique combination. It is my real given name. My parents are hippies. They were
That's awesome.
That stuff.
Awesome.
People have always thought it's a stage name or expected me to be Asian.
Right.
And neither is true.
I thought you would have some Asian descent because Lau Tizer almost sounds like, I actually thought your last name was German.
Okay.
And your first name, obviously, I thought was Chinese
right.
or Asian of some sort. So that's interesting. And they just were like, I want to make something unique, make it totally different. And you're like, here I am, world.
That's right. I mean, so I'm the youngest. My mom has four kids.
Okay.
Two with a different dad. And I'm the youngest of the four. We all have pretty unique names. So Lau, my sister's Nadja. My brother's Ari, which is actually a pretty common Jewish name.
That's tame.
And my eldest sister is Che,
awesome.
Named after Che Guevara.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they were, you know, my parents met in Berkeley back in the early 70s, and they were East Coast kids, but they were hippies and, you know,
of the times. Kids strong names.
That's so right.
Make it loud and proud.
As long as people can pronounce it right, then it's cool. But as you might imagine, I've heard every pronunciation under the sun.
Well, my name's Nikhil Carulla, so I have all the compassion in the world for anybody who messes up your name, because it's been my whole life. You know what I mean? You were probably the same kid when you were growing up where a substitute would come in and they'd pause at your name for maybe 2 seconds. Did they ever do that? Because that was every time there was a substitute.
Yeah, or just butcher it. I mean, it's L-A-O,
right?
But people call me Leo, Teo, Lo, Loa, you know,
like,
everything.
No.
Yeah.
Like, no, no, and no.
Yeah, I don't get where people get Teo from. I mean, I guess my last name, I don't know, some kind
dyslexia.
Yeah,
exactly.
I don't know.
So let's just jump right into it. So you got the bug for music early on, I assume. Mm-hmm. Tell me that moment of zen where you just knew you wanted to be a musician or you wanted to play.
Okay, so it all started for me, actually, when my parents got a piano for my sister, who's about 2 years older. She was going to be the one to take lessons. I was like 5, and I was just the one that took natural interest in it. I used to just kind of like improvise around and literally like bang around on the piano and make stuff up, and I would like sit there for an hour. I mean, I think it's pretty unusual for like a 5-year-old kid or 6-year-old kid to entertain themselves for that long. And one of their friends was, well, a couple of their friends were piano teachers, but showed me like the most basic rudiments, like what a fifth was, whatever. So I'd just play around with that stuff. But it took them years before they actually got me lessons.
Wow.
So I started lessons.
Because they didn't think you were serious. Like, he's just messing up.
You know, my dad is a character and my family story is a whole other scene. But he moved quite slow and was really very specific about curriculum and that kind of stuff. So he wanted to create like the curriculum. He came from a family that was very oriented towards like classical music. So my great-grandfather, which is the only person in my family that was into music, and I never even met him. I met him when I was a baby, but I don't remember him. He was a piano teacher from Russia. And so my grandma was, they were kind of a society family in Philadelphia.
So he was giving you Rachmaninoff.
Yeah, so he was really into classical music.
Right.
World music.
Oh, well, that's awesome.
And of course, the music of, you know, they're boomers. My mom's 71, my dad's 70. So, you know, Buddy Holly and Sam Cooke and Elvis Presley and Motown. And the Temptations were my favorite band when I was like a five-year-old kid. In Boulder, well, then I was in the middle of nowhere in Southern Colorado, actually called Salida. So I can't imagine there's too many five-year-old kids who are big Temptations fans down there.
Probably not.
But they were not jazz heads, though. I didn't discover that part until later on.
So did you study classical music?
Yes. Yeah. So like most pianists start out with classical music. And I was always improvising since before I ever started. So that was really my most natural gift, was to write and to improvise and, you know, create my own stuff. And so I started classical lessons, like formal lessons, basically when I was nine, just before I turned nine. And
probably playing a lot of Mozart, Bach.
Yeah, all the normal stuff. Yeah, a lot of Bach, especially like when you're young. And I studied with a couple different teachers that were friends of theirs. And one of them had actually just finished up school at the University of Colorado in Boulder. She had just gotten a degree in classical piano and performance. And I ended up a few years, like when I was about 13, she referred me to her old professor. So I studied with her privately. But again, nobody that was like into composition. So that side was always just kind of my own thing. And it's kind of, yeah, it's quite interesting that I have never actually studied with a compositional teacher.
Wow.
I guess once I got to LA and then I studied with a very well-known pianist here named Terry Trotter. And this was when I was like 18, 19. And certainly that's where I first got like exposed to jazz and deeper harmony and that kind of stuff. And Terry had a big impact.
What was the jazz artist that just was the door opening into that world?
Right. So the first time that my ears really opened to jazz, because I remember when I was like, you know, 12, 13. The thing is, classical music and jazz are related in ways, but in many ways, jazz breaks all the rules of classical music, right? Right. Mm-hmm. So, but if you're kind of accustomed to the formula of classical music harmonically, and that's mostly what you're playing, jazz is like pushing your boundaries, right?
Right.
So, so it took a minute for my ears to open up to that, but I remember the day, it was like I was junior in high school, and it was like Sunday morning, and I got up and, you know, smoked some weed and put on my Miles Davis and Quincy Jones Live at Montreux CD that I gotten from Columbia House, right? We all had those.
Oh,
remember,
right.
You know, buy 12, get one free, or buy one, get 12 free, whatever
right.
it was. And that was the first time it was like that, and Miles Davis Kind of Blue, and that kind of stuff. That's where my ears opened, really. Like, I was already into, like, the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers, which, certainly with the Allman Brothers, there's elements of jazz in it. But
yeah,
it's still a long ways from, like...
Well, you got Chuck Lavelle doing all the...
I love Chuck.
He's my favorite, man.
Yeah, he's great.
And he's actually doing a lot of jazz now, which is, like, crazy.
Yeah, you know, he tours around, and we've played some events and stuff and series that I know he's been on, but I've never met him. Like, we've never been on the same show, same day at a festival. I would love to meet him, though, because, I mean,
yeah,
that guy...
He's
so many people,
he's a beast.
Yeah, so many people don't know how many records he's on.
He's on all the best records.
Yeah,
you know,
Rolling Stones.
Eric Clapton, Allman Brothers.
Allman Brothers, all that shit.
Yeah, all the best stuff.
Excuse my French.
No. Your French is accepted here. So when did you know you wanted to kind of explore jazz and, you know, kind of distance yourself from classical music?
Yeah, so I was definitely a proficient classical pianist, but, you know, there was other students that were studying with my teacher who were stronger. And I always had this compositional improvisational side. So it's just, I always say, it's kind of a natural progression. If you're an instrumentalist, I'm not a singer.
Right.
So if you're an instrumentalist and you want to get deeper into composition, improvisation, that's kind of the next frontier, naturally. So there's definitely elements, and people still tell me to this day, they can hear the classical influence in my stuff. You can't shake that. You are who you are. But it was in, yeah, like my later teens, and then when I moved to LA and I started to get surrounded by people who were pushing my boundaries a bit, and, you know, you got to challenge your ears.
Well, I asked because, you know, that was a major crossroads for me because I did classical music my whole life, and I was like exposed to jazz, but not in a way that, you know, I saw like Ella Fitzgerald at the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah, very
I was
cool.
A really young kid, and I actually got the chance to meet Miles Davis.
Okay.
I sang at the Grammy Awards when I was a kid.
Very cool.
And he was rehearsed. I got to watch him rehearse, and I had no idea who he was. I was 11 years old. So, you know, when I went through this phase of like, okay, I get to the music school, and they're like pounding classical music into me, and they don't like you kind of going into any other kind of realms or genres. Jazz was like this, it was total freedom.
Right.
You know, I was like, oh my God, and you can do anything you want, or you can do classical music.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it was like that huge crossroads for me. So I always like hearing when somebody's exposed to both or gets the training, you like, I know you probably appreciate the training that you got for classical music.
I mean, for pianists, there's no better foundation than to play classical music. I mean, technically, the proficiency, the proper technique and approach and control and all that kind of stuff. But as my old teacher Terry would say, and he was a very accomplished classical pianist. I remember him telling me he was studying with Victor Feldman at the time, I think, and also playing classical music. And he was like, you know, he told me, he's like, listen, you're a great classical pianist and you could be in the top 5%, maybe even the top 2%.
Wow.
But that doesn't really mean anything in classical music. You like to be a concert pianist, you have to be in the like top 0.1 of 1%. And classical music, by its nature, it's interpretive, but it's recreative as opposed to naturally creative.
Right.
And I mean, Terry must have said that to me when I was like 18. I never forgot that quote. Like,
so that was the opening of the door.
Yeah, and I mean, it was already, you know, I kind of stumbled into a career in music a little bit, like, which we can touch on, like, the story. But, you know, it was natural. I was already writing my own music. I was into improvisation and composition, but I wasn't pushing harmonic boundaries.
Right.
So that's where that really stepped in, and it just opened. I mean, man, it was like, you know, you open Pandora's box and you're like, you know, it's a tritone substitution, and it really opens your eyes, and that was very exciting. You know.
So who were the composers or jazz musicians? Like Brad Meldow is like one of my favorite pianists. You know, T-Monk obviously is another one that just kind of opened these kind of doors of what's possible.
Sure.
Who were the either jazz musicians or the composers that made you really push the limits?
So you already touched on one. I mean, Chuck Lavelle was mostly a studio guy.
Yeah.
But when I was getting into listening to more like classic rock and that kind of stuff during...
Hold on, we got a caller real quick.
Let's
see who this is. Hello, you're on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. This is Bixby, and I just heard you guys talking about something about relationships, and you were asking Natalie if she was in a relationship or not, and she said that she was dating.
Hold on.
I think you're calling.
I think you're calling a different show. There's another show on the other. On the other network, so you may have to call in again. We're talking music here.
Oh, okay. My bad, you guys.
No problem. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Or we could dive into that.
Have a good night. That happens. It just happens. We get calls from Costa Rica sometimes. Sometimes they're for us.
There you go.
Sometimes they're not, you know. But anyways, all right, so... You're listening to all these musicians,
right?
The composer. You said Chuck Lavelle was amazing.
Right. So in high school, before I kind of like crossed over and really started to like dive into listening to jazz, that still, you know, the kind of improvisation that's going on in soloing or whatever in like the Allman Brothers, that stuff, it's starting to open your ears as a classical pianist, like predominantly like it's playing with a different style, like more bluesy licks and that kind of stuff. And I was always like, man, what is the technique behind that?
Right.
So that, you know, he definitely was a big influence. Like Bruce Hornsby is one of my favorites.
Oh, he's the best.
And Bruce definitely comes from that school in a lot of ways. And, you know, he really plays jazz and, you know, he's a very accomplished musician. But I mean, as far as if you're going to talk about piano, so as a kid, like the classical guys, I love Vladimir Horowitz, of course. Rubinstein. I got to see Vladimir Ashkenazi and Peter Sorkin, Aaron Sorkin, Peter Sorkin.
Yeah, right.
At like Mackey Auditorium and up at the campus when I was like in, you know, probably sixth grade or something like that. And then as I started to get into that, of course, like Chick Corea.
Keith Jarrett.
I love, of course, Bill Evans. Wynton Kelly. I loved Wynton Kelly's playing, especially on Kind of Blue. He's a lot of that is Bill Evans, and a couple of the tracks are Wynton. I think Wynton's on one or two of them.
That's right.
And again, he had that kind of. It was different than Chuck Lavelle's approach, but I liked the kind of like bluesy licks oriented stuff. For some reason, like Southern influence, like Southern rock and Southern influence kind of playing came very naturally to me. It was like really attractive. I don't really know why. It's
soul oriented.
Yeah. And it just intuitively kind of came to me. And of course Herbie Hancock, I mean, you know, for every pianist of my generation and of the generation before, I mean, you'd be remiss if you didn't mention him as one of the true icons. So, you know, all those guys. And
hold on, we got another caller. Let's see if it's for us. Let's see. Hold on.
We can do relationship advice.
Hi, you're on Wake Up Hollywood. Who's this?
Hi, I'm calling in.
Yes, for which show? Just in case we just had a caller call in.
Oh, sorry. the Dave Brown and Natalie Jillian?
Nope. Wrong show again. Call in on another line.
Okay.
We should just take one of these calls and pretend to be them the next time.
Usually they're for us, but you know, there's a new show, so they must be talking to relationships in the other room. So, Oscar Peterson, I'm surprised you didn't say anything about Oscar Peterson.
Of course, Oscar Peterson. Although I didn't get into listening to him as much until a bit later, but you know, like into my 20s. And you know, if you get a late start, like a lot of my friends who are jazz heads, right, were listening to this stuff probably when they were a bit younger than me. I was just scratching the surface by like my late teens, so there was a lot to catch up on, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I also, I guess because of kind of my style and what comes naturally to me, fusion oriented stuff was always like kind of spoke to me. So like when I first heard Chick Corea, Return to Forever and that stuff, right, especially the stuff off Romantic Warrior where he's playing acoustic piano, I was just like, you know, jaw dropping. So,
well, he was an innovator big time. Spain, I mean, that's
sure.
One of the best jazz pieces ever.
Sure. One of the most recognized too.
So did you listen to Weather Report, all those guys too?
Of course, all that stuff. Yeah. And then, you know, honestly, a lot of my big influences have been people that I'm fortunate to work with. I'm lucky to work with some of the really outstanding musicians out there. And so they all have a big, effect.
Let's play some music. Right. What do you want to start with? You want to start with that Led Zeppelin cover?
Sure. That's a little surprise for people. Yeah. I
love it. Honestly, and actually my engineer Ronan was like, man, I love this guy's version of Ramble On. I'm like, it's killer. It's just awesome.
Thank you.
So before we jump into it, tell us a little like backstory. What made you want to cover it?
Right. So this record, the new record, which just came out about 6 months ago called Songs from the Swing House, is a CD and DVD combo pack that was recorded all live in the studio and filmed simultaneously, 8 cameras. So everything is live. All the videos are live and the audio performances are the same, right? So it's a combo pack, and we've released now about 7 of the videos of 11. We just released the 7th one last week. So my band has always been all original instrumental music, and for this record I decided it was time to add a vocalist and try covering something. So we did 3 covers for this record, and this is one. And again, this music is music that I'm connected to since my teenage years when I was, you know, kind of a hippie kid in Boulder, right? So it was the music of the 70s was the most popular among my friends. And I also just, you know, jazz groups don't touch on Zeppelin. And I was just like, think outside the box. Like, do something unpredictable and push some boundaries. And we found a great singer, Tita Hutchison, who's been a perfect addition to the group. And I have to say, working up arrangements for this tune and the couple other covers we did was so fun. Because I've never done that. It's always been just compose your own. So that's kind of the backstory.
Let's jump into that. This is Lau Tizer with Ramble On.
A pleasant stay, but now it's time for me to go. The autumn moon lights my way. Now I smell the rain, and with it pain, and it's heading my way. Yeah. Sometimes I has come to be gone. Though to your health we drank a thousand times, it's time to ramble on.
Great, interesting arrangement, full of a lot of love and life, man. How did you decide on putting fiddle on this tune and the arrangement of it?
Yeah, so, you know, as we were talking about while it was playing off air, you know, we did three covers for the record. We did this, we did Pride in the Name of Love by U2, and then Sad Lisa by Cat Stevens.
Great choices.
Which was also, I mean, Cat Stevens, you know, it was... Tea for the Tillman was one of my favorite records in high school, too. So it was very natural. But with Ramble On, it's such an iconic tune, and there's such iconic parts in it. I felt like we could only push the boundaries so far in how we approach the arrangement. I didn't want to veer too far off from the original. So, like, the tempo's similar, the bass line's there, those melodies are there. And then, you know, we had some fun reharmonizing chords under, like, under the melody section at the end. And so Karen Briggs is on fiddle. And Karen is just an absolute beast. And she's been working with the band a long time. She's super well-known. You might have seen her. Like, a lot of people know her best from her days with Yanni. She was on all those big PBS specials. She's the lady in red, the violinist. Okay. So, and Karen's done so much stuff, man. She's worked with, you know, Diana Ross and Chaka Khan and Wu-Tang Clan and Stanley Clarke.
Who are those people? I'm just kidding.
Exactly. So, I mean, it was just a natural fit. And then I was like, okay, let's put strings. Like, I wrote a string arrangement for it just because I was like, that's a way to kind of put our stamp on it and push the boundaries while still staying rooted in some of those key elements of the original. So that was the concept.
I want to talk to you about leaving Colorado to come to L.A. Mm-hmm. What was the allure about it? Or did you feel like you kind of graduated from one pond and you were ready for a different pond? What was the reasoning for wanting to come to L.A.?
Right. So I graduated high school in 96, and I was already gigging. I'd been gigging since, like, my junior, sophomore year of high school. And actually, the way that ended up coming about is that I was playing piano already. I wanted to get a keyboard. I was used to go to the store when I was, like, 8, 10, 12 years old, you know, whatever. I'd go to the music store when I could get someone to give me a lift, and I was always like, oh, all these cool other sounds, right? So my parents were like, okay, we'll loan you the money. And you have to pay us back, like, I don't remember, it was like 60% of it or whatever. So I started performing to make that money. And I put out my first couple self-produced solo, keyboard albums, literally recorded at home, like, direct to DAT. You know what I mean?
Awesome.
I was like 15 years old.
Old school.
Right, old school, exactly. And my first manager saw me playing in downtown Denver in, like, September of 96. And my cousin at that time was living with me, and he was selling merch at shows. And he flew us both out here, and then, we didn't really know if it was real. You know, I think if you don't know anything about the music business and whatever, and some guy from LA is like, yeah, I want to fly you out to LA. And, you know, we were like, I remember, like, he called me and I did, like, *69 or whatever. Right. And I forgot that someone else had called in between, and it was like a 303 Denver area code. And I was like, see, it's a sham.
He's a phony. He's just monkeying around.
So he flew us out, and I came out again a few months later, and then I decided to move here. And I decided to move here. I had, like, you know, whatever for an 18-year-old kid, like, a couple grand in the bank, and it's 1997. And I'm like, okay, well, I can go and, you know, I can survive a couple months and see what it's going to be. I came here by myself.
That's crazy.
I got in my old 1981 Ford Toyota long bed, 4x4, loaded down, and with a camper shell, and my buddy Nate rode out with me. We left Denver actually at night, so we'd end up getting to LA like in the evening the next day. And we were, you know, driving over like Vail Pass and second gear. I mean, it was like, you know, old four-cylinder truck, like way down. Everything I owned, you know, was in the back of the truck, in the camper shell, or in that trailer. And
where did you come first? Like, where did you live first?
So when I'd been out here the last time before I moved out here in the beginning of March, and I'd been out here, I think, in like late January before that, and I found a place renting a room from a guy in Calabasas at Malibu Canyon Apartments.
Wow.
So off Las Virgenes Canyon
pretty nice.
Road.
That's a pretty nice way to come in.
There you go.
Way.
That's how I ended up out here. And my manager's family, like, he has sons, or my former manager, I should say, he has sons almost exact same age as me. Like, his eldest son is 10 days older than me, and his middle son is 2.5 years younger. So I already had, and they really, like, took me in as part of their family. So I was living, they lived in Agora, so I was close to them. I wanted to be close because I didn't know anybody out here.
Right.
And, you know, I started gigging, and things kind of took off, and, you know, here I am 21 years later. I still haven't left.
It's the best. I mean, honestly, I'm from here, so that's why I always like hearing the stories about musicians taking that leap, because it is a leap. You know?
It's a leap.
Yeah. I think the only leap from here is New York, you know, really.
Sure.
But the one thing I love about L.A. is the weather, the players, the vibe. I mean, there is a scene here, but it's like, it's different than New York, where it's like everything's like in your face.
Sure.
LA is like this, like, soft pat on the back and then a quick, you know, quick pitch slap.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember, so I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, which is a kind of a bubble, you know, I mean, Denver's there, and Denver is also kind of a bubble, not as much as Boulder is, but I'd grown up most of my life in Boulder in a very protected environment. It's a very yuppie town.
Right.
And also very not diverse, right? So by the time I got out here, I remember like my oldest sister and my brother, they thought I was going to go through like culture shock. And I never did. It was just like, whatever.
It's the same.
I adjusted
same
well. I mean, it was, you know, it was just a big city and a lot to explore. And you know, LA is not an easy place to move to, I don't think.
Right.
I've had this conversation many times with people over the years. Like, it's amazing you can live in a city of so many people. Like, what, the greater LA area now is basically 20 million people.
Right.
You know, if you include all the surrounding counties, right, that sprawl together. How can you feel lonely in a city of 20 million people, right? It's really a remarkable thing. So it took me time to, like, you know, make a network of friends. And I was also, at that time, before, this is just before I'd started the band, I was also playing all my shows as a solo keyboardist.
Right.
So it's not like I was connecting with other musicians and making those kind of natural friendships that happen so easily through, you know, people
of
a common thread. So and I've met lots of people in the years since I've been here who have just moved out here and have experienced those same things. I'm like, you just gotta, you know, stick with it. And then I know other people who have moved here, and this makes me really happy, who got tied into kind of my group of friends early on, like through a buddy or whatever. And, you know, young dudes, I'm like, man, you're really lucky.
Yeah.
Like, you met some quality people who are good, down-to-earth people, because LA also has this whole other side to it, right?
Yeah.
Especially...
You have to sort through the madness.
To find the sincerity, to find the real people, you know, because there's the whole Hollywood scene and the, you know... And I mean, back in those days, it was like Sky Bar.
Yes,
you know, that,
I remember those days.
That whole thing, right? So, yeah, it's just, you know, it's been a great journey, and I have a lot of great friends here and a great musical network here. And I love Colorado, too. I still think of it as home. And maybe I'll move back at some point, but obviously...
But not until later.
But I'll always be tied to LA,
Let's get to another track. What do you want to play next?
Let's do Metropolis.
All right.
Yeah. This is a fun one.
Here comes Metropolis.
We'll be right back.
by the way, great solo on that.
Oh, thank you.
It was awesome.
I appreciate it.
I was listening. I was listening. Thank you. We were talking, but I always leave one can on the ear so I could hear it. Oh, man, what an arrangement. The
thank
horn
you.
Arrangements.
Thank you.
Man, the solos, they were great.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a fun tune. That was the first video that we released from it. And it was actually the last tune, like I was telling you off air. It was the last tune I finished writing literally 6 weeks before the sessions.
Wow.
And then, so I did horn arrangements and Bijan Watson did the horn orchestrations, great trumpeter who does like, let's see, Bijan does both Monkestra, John Beasley's Monkestra, and does John DeVerse's big band and
those
plays
are some,
on all
those
sorts
are some
yeah.
good bands, right?
Yeah,
there.
And he like, plays on, so that was great. And then, so that was the biggest configuration tune from the project. That was the one on like day two of the sessions, 15 musicians, all live, 8 camera operators, and we're in Conway Studio C, the big room,
right.
And we used every input.
Wow.
All 64. It was like, the engineer's like, we don't have anything left, man. That's it.
You're like, this is
you're
awesome.
Done. That was a great high, man. Like when we were just running the tune before we actually rolled tape into just like, I had this vision in my head for weeks, right? I had done the arrangements, and when you get to actually sit there and play it with both the horns and the strings live, right. It's just like, man.
Like, this is why I love me.
That's the payoff. Yeah. I mean, you know, all the hard work, like we were saying off air, that people just don't know what goes into, you know, to pull off a project like this. But that's that gratification you get just for yourself.
Right.
That was a great moment, man.
Now, I was going to ask you this. Did you do any of it to tape, or did you do it digitally? Did you mix and match a little bit on each side? Or
So it was all recorded live, right? So the performances are all live. It was recorded to Pro Tools through, they have a great Neve, I think it's an 88R at Conway C. And so we did all the mixing, and then he edited the video once we had like the mixes pretty much done, just because it's easier from an editing standpoint. But no, it all is what it is. That tune, most of these tunes we got, I think that was the third take.
Wow. How many takes did you do of each song?
Most of them were 3 or 4. There's a couple trickier tunes. One of them, which is one of the favorite live tunes actually, called 16th Heaven. We actually had a brownout. I don't know what the odds are of that in LA, but there was high winds and lost power at the studio. It was like 9:30 at night. So all the headphone cues got screwed up, and it's the hardest tune on the record. So that one we ended up having to do extra takes of because of that. And I think we ended up, maybe there was like 7 or 8 of that one, but most of them we knocked out in 3 or 4.
Don't you find that every time you're in the studio, there's some hiccup?
Yeah.
There's always some small, like, every record I've ever done, I always know it's going to happen. I look for the thorn.
Right.
And it's just that we put up with so much bullshit for the love and joy of making that record.
Sure.
But when you actually get it done and the CD arrives and all the mixing and mastering, everything's complete, there's nothing more gratifying. It's before even people hear it, you're like, man, it's an accomplishment. It's a great accomplishment.
Right.
So congrats.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's really... I think a good analogy to it, I mean, as men, we'll never experience this for ourselves, but it is like giving birth.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
And except, I guess, you give birth and then you have to raise that kid. Whereas we, like, you know, after you finish the record, you've listened to everything so many times for mixes, analyzed, taken notes, like, just the level of detail is crazy. And so people ask, you know, will ask me, like, do you listen to it? I'm like, no.
Well, you will, though, in
someday.
Like 10 years,
yeah.
8 years. And the crazy thing that I've found is like you listen to it and you hear different things.
Sure.
Or forget about things
sure.
that surprise you. And you lived it. So
right.
it's like none of it should be a surprise. But
sure.
The coolest thing about it, I think, about records in general, they're like living, breathing things.
Sure.
So what you're hearing now, 10 years later, you're going to hear it in a completely different way.
Right.
And that's what people don't understand. Like I found that with records I loved. If I listen to a Michael Jackson record now, it's not the same as when I was listening to it as a kid.
Especially with music that is deep in its context and either composition or arrangement or just has like a depth to it.
Right.
There's layers to peel back and it takes time to peel those layers back. And your own mindset at the time you're listening colors those things. So your own life experience, right? 5 years from now, you look back and it gives you a different perspective. Not even, it's all just subconscious, right? Just the impressions that we get. But yeah, very much so. I mean, it's, you know, it's just... like, I think something that all artists probably struggle with, especially in the digital age, where you can literally mix and mix and edit and mix and forever because right. it's on a computer. Back in the day, all those records that we all love, right, growing up with the 70s and 80s, no, it was like, man, you get the mix and that's the mix.
Well, you know, you'd be surprised, though, because I remember, you know, Bernie Grumman, he masters all the records that I do, especially the last couple. And he told me that the Bodyguard soundtrack had 162 mixes for the big,
right.
you know, I will always love sure. you, the big Whitney Houston sure. song. And I'm like, 162 mixes? What was the one they chose for the mastering? And he was like, mix number 3. So it's like they did a lot of mixes. Right. They threw a lot of money in sure. places where it was superfluous.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, it is like, you know, what I've learned with making records, it's like there's just – no, there's no wrong and right. There's just a different 98%.
Right.
Know, like you get 98% and then you can remix it and do another version of 98% and another version of 98%. So it's like it'll just sound different in right ways, but they're all correct.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of perfection is on its face not practical. And actually, it's not what you want
from
music. Like, and this is what's happened to pop music right today, right? Like, it's almost sometimes I hear stuff, and I, you know, I don't listen to much pop music. I'll be honest. Like, right. I'd never have Kiss FM on in the car, whatever station it is that's playing
all lies,
pop music.
Lies,
but it has like it's so immaculate. It's almost like when you look at a like sometimes I look at like a 4K TV and a Blu-ray DVD, and I'm like, it doesn't look real.
Right,
it's too clean.
It's too clean. Yeah.
So it is, especially in this kind of music, it's the human, like it's our flaws and right. the humanity in it that makes it real and special. It's those moments that like in the studio, I look back and I listen to stuff, that particular tune Metropolis. I remember after the session, I was really like in between songs. I was really down on myself. I didn't like my solo. I felt like I could play better, whatever. Oh, and I was beating great. Myself up. And then I listened back and I go, man, like there was a lot of cool stuff there. And you know, so you,
but that's
you can
always
be your
how
own worst. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I just read an article that Jimi Hendrix hated Electric Ladyland. Like what? He didn't like the mix. He didn't like one of his solos. Like,
right.
It just, you know, it just shows that you care.
Right.
That's
I mean,
the cool thing.
Yeah, I think it's, and that's something that comes with maturity is to realize that what all these things are recordings, especially in more organic oriented music, is just a moment in time.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all you're trying to capture.
I'm sure you're like this too, but I actually want more mistakes and more things
sure.
like that, more blemishes on records. As I get older, I don't want it to be perfect. And
sure.
all of my records have a little bit more breathing room and more just soul in it as a result, because it has that, you know.
I can't tell you how many songs I've written that came out of a mistake, meaning I was playing something else, practicing at home, or maybe right. even on a gig, and I right. played something wrong, and I was like, well, that's kind of
like,
cool.
Wait a minute.
I mean, literally, that's probably like one quarter of the tunes I've ever written came right. out of some kind of a stumble like that. So that is the magic of music and to pursue perfection. I mean, to be a great player and to have command of your instrument is one thing, and that's
right.
something that I'll be striving for decades
well, that's,
to
that's,
come.
That's it.
But to also understand that it's like, man, it's your personality that comes out. I mean, there's always going to be better pianists.
Right.
There's always going to be a better singer. There's always going to be a better guitar player. But there's nobody that can be a better you.
Right.
So if you master your voice and your voice has something and you nurture that and you trust it and you kind of are pure about it, then
only good things.
That's it.
Yeah.
And the rest you can't really control.
You've got some shows coming up.
Yes.
Let's promote those real quick. Where are you playing?
Okay, so we'll be down at a big festival in Tampa Bay area, Florida, on Saturday called the Clearwater Jazz Holiday, which is actually in Clearwater, but it's right next to Tampa. And that's a really big festival. This is our second time there, and it's been like a good 8 or 9 years, so I'm super stoked to be going back.
That's awesome.
And that'll be the large configuration of the group. We tour as like a trio up to an 8-piece. So this is the 8-piece with the vocals and with Karen on violin and Kieli Minucci and Gene Coy and Manyungo Jackson, all these great cats. We're playing on Saturday. The headliners, the Doobie Brothers, the Fabulous Thunderbirds are right after us. So
that's
it
awesome.
Should be really fun.
Yeah.
And then we're back in LA on Tuesday, and we'll be at Herb Alpert's place up in Bel Air, Vibrato.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite jazz
Yeah, guys. As a quartet. So we'll be there Tuesday night, the 23rd. At 7:30, and that's always a really fun room and great food. Really, like the most beautiful room in like greater LA area that I can think of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Aesthetically wise, just
you know, gorgeous. It was built by a musician. You know, just,
and you know all the paintings are his? Did you
really?
Know that?
I didn't
he
know
did
that.
All those, yeah. Wow. I didn't know that until recently, and someone was like, yeah, those are all his. That's all his artwork, because there's those giant canvases up on the wall. So
he's a badass.
Yeah, a talented guy and pretty Renaissance man, you know. So, yeah, and then actually it's been a really busy year, which is great. I'll always be thankful for that.
Yeah.
But I actually get to be home for 2 weekends without any travel.
Yes.
So I'll take that. And then November's pretty full on. So, yeah, so that's nice. It's, you know, I love traveling and I love touring, but we've been out for some pretty long runs and there's a lot of early morning flights and,
man, honestly,
and it takes
like
it out of you.
Less
you
know? And less as I get older. Not that I like playing out less, but I love being home more.
Right.
You know, there's something about that. I just love it.
So. Sure. And to be able to just like, also for, you know, because the record came out this year, there's always an extra push that goes on, like, you know, all the business stuff associated with it, not necessarily shows, but like all the deadlines you have to meet, all the pushing, the promotion, overseeing stuff. And, you know, that's unfortunately that falls on the artist in most cases these days. You can hire a great team, which we did, but still I was the quarterback kind of.
Right.
So between that and then touring a bunch this year with both my group,
like, I'm
and
ready
special,
for that break.
It's like, yeah, you've got to recharge, you know.
And where can people find you online? Like, tell us all your links.
Right. Okay. Handles. So obviously the website is just myname.com. So that's Lautizer, spelled LAO, T as in Tom, I, Z as in zebra, ER.com. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/Lautizer Band. On Instagram, it's just Instagram/Lautizer. And on YouTube, it's youtube.com/Lautizer Official. And that's a place, if you folks out there enjoy what you heard, please go and check out the videos from the project. Because if you enjoyed listening, watching these guys in action in the studio,
it's live art, man.
It's really something special. And I hope people will check it out. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, let's get to another song. This one's called The Source. And this one goes out to Todd Campbell for being the source for this interview.
That's
He's
right.
He introduced us together. So, yeah, man, let's hear The Source by Lautizer. Awesome. Lau, that you were such a fantastic guest. We're going to have to have you back, man.
Oh, I'd love to. Great chatting.
Dude,
man.
We'll have to do this again. This is like a music hang. I love it. And next time, we're going to make sure you meet Eddie, who's the ghost in the room right now. But
right.
Eddie Pence, on behalf of Eddie, myself, and Lau, we'll see you guys next week.